Part 5. The Justice on Judging and Justice. Introduction. This chapter samples Justice Ginsburg's speeches, lectures, and articles on the nature of the court on which she serves, the job of the justices, and the standards they do, or in her view, should observe, as they carry out their duty faithfully to apply the provisions of the United States Constitution and interpret the statutes passed by Congress. Striking to us is the way the justice would give a speech, adapt it to other occasions, use its various points in different contexts, and in one or more iterations, add footnotes and usher it into print. These varied iterations gave us the latitude to opt for shorter and more widely accessible treatments of the subjects that captured her attention over her years as a justice. A similar process was evident in the briefs Lawyer Ginsburg wrote for the gender equality cases she brought to the Supreme Court in the 1970s, briefs that organically grew or shrank, changed in emphasis, or altered in their details over the course of years. Husband Marty Ginsburg characterized his spouse's evolutionary process. In the old days, there was the brief, and now it's the speech. Ruth Ginsburg is not one given to abstract constructs or dramatic flourishes. Her voice in public and on paper is modest and measured, yet her style is distinctive, and her point is often captured in a memorable quotation from someone else or a notable and quotable pithy quip of her own. Her legal analyses dig deep into the real world, its history and quotidian details, and the way institutions, large and small, public and private, interact with each other and with democracy's people. Always, she pays careful attention to the history and purpose, fairness and effectiveness, of the rules that shape and direct our justice system. Throughout her speeches and writings, she includes side glances at the justice systems of sister democracies, for the light they shine on our own, and offers homage to the way pavers and the path markers who have improved our world through law. At the heart of the concerns she addresses in the documents selected for this chapter is respect for the dignity and equality of all. Workways. We begin with Justice Ginsburg's primer on the workways of the Supreme Court, invaluable for understanding what she calls the procedures at my workplace, from how the justices select the cases they review, to the nature and purpose of oral arguments before the court, or how the justices reach their decisions and compose and release their written opinions to the public. For anyone from first-year law students to lay people seeking to understand the court, there could be no better guide. Truth be told, Justice Ginsburg has some rather unusual workways herself. Her ability to go without a normal night's sleep is legendary. Her propensity for working until around 4 a.m. and arriving at her chambers in the late morning, earlier when the court is in session, sitting for oral argument, is known to every clerk and assistant. Her sleeplessness is part of a habit that started in high school and continued in college, where after her roommates went to bed, she crept away to a quiet place to study into the wee hours. But we digress. The second article in this chapter addresses what Justice Ginsburg considers the essential predicate of the work of the court, judicial independence. Her thesis, supported with historical and current examples, essential to the rule of law in any land, is an independent judiciary. Judges not under the thumb of other branches of government, and therefore equipped to administer the law impartially. Judicial independence, however, can be shattered if the society law exists to serve does not take care to ensure its preservation. Third in this trio comes Justice Ginsburg's tribute to Chief Justice Rehnquist on the occasion of his death in office from cancer in early September 2005. Her tribute gives a human face and personal touch to one who held the august title Chief Justice of the United States for nearly 20 years. Justice Ginsburg's reflections both expand the reader's understanding of any Chief Justice's unique, first among equals, position in the court's workways and underscore this particular chief's skillful management of the court and commitment to an independent judiciary. William Hobbs Rehnquist was, she said, hands down the fairest and most efficient boss she ever had. Judging. Just months before President Clinton nominated her to the Supreme Court in the summer of 1993, Judge Ginsburg delivered a lecture-turned-law review article, speaking in a judicial voice on the appropriate style and substance of judging. The introductory paragraphs reveal her judicial philosophy, where she stands on the spectrum between originalists, adherence to what they perceive as the founders' original understanding of the Constitution, and those who espouse a living Constitution whose fundamental principles should be interpreted in light of changing circumstances the founders could not have imagined. Invoking Madison and Hamilton, Ginsburg endorses the concept of a living Constitution. She illustrates her vision with a brief history of the American ideal of equality, a concept limited at the nation's founding by a culture that kept early Americans from fully perceiving or acting upon ideals of human equality and dignity, but which, she notes, had growth potential. The story of the Constitution, she says, is the extension of constitutional rights and protections to once excluded groups, to people who were once held in bondage, to men without property, to Native Americans, and to women. After laying this groundwork, Ginsburg turns to the style and substance of judging. On style, she endorses collegiality between judges and taking the high ground in their courtrooms and in their written opinions. Ginsburg advocates this approach not for manners' sake, although one senses she believes good manners are generally a good thing, but because collegiality leads to better opinions and enhances public respect for and confidence in the judiciary. She includes illustrative, spicy examples of intemperate language from actual opinions and even names a few names, albeit in the footnotes. On substance, she says, "Measured motions seem to me right in the main for constitutional as well as common law adjudication. Doctrinal limbs too swiftly shaped, experience teaches, may prove unstable, thereby placing stress on the judicial institution." In the Madison lecture, she offered Roe v. Wade as a prime example of the Supreme Court doing too much too soon. In Ginsburg's view, the court's encompassing decision in Roe fueled enduring political controversy and failed to home in on a key dimension of the problem, that a woman's ability to control her reproductive life is critical to equality in life and law. In her view, judges are not platonic guardians, but play an interdependent part in democracy, participating in a dialogue with other organizations of government and with the people as well. To Justice Ginsburg, history teaches that the court should avoid either impeding or leaping too far ahead of the political process, instead engaging in a temperate brand of decision-making that proceeds incrementally, ordinarily deciding what is required by the case before it and leaving further development to later cases. Comparative side glances and the equality ideal. In A Decent Respect to the Opinions of Humankind, Justice Ginsburg, cognizant of congressional controversy in recent years over the Supreme Court's citations to foreign law, the rulings of national, multinational, and international courts other than our own, makes the case that looking beyond our borders is altogether fitting and proper for lawyers and judges in the United States. From the earliest days of the Supreme Court to the 21st century, she shows, justices have cited cases decided by the courts of other nations and international bodies. She notes that even Justice Scalia, a vocal opponent of the practice, had indulged in it on occasion. Indeed, such comparative side glances at the work of legal institutions beyond our shores have been her own practice as lawyer, law teacher, judge, and justice, and a recurring feature of her articles and speeches. In Brown v. Board, in international context, Justice Ginsburg explores how that decision both reflected and advanced international human rights developments. The international response during the World War II era to the rank racism of the Nazis created a dilemma for the United States. How to maintain prestige and moral leadership in the world, given its own policies of racial segregation, including the segregation of African-American soldiers fighting and dying in the war against Hitler. The Supreme Court's 1954 Brown decision, reported around the world, she reflects, propelled an evolution yet unfinished toward respect in law and in practice for the human dignity of all the world's people, and inspired her own work on behalf of women's rights. In a brief and poignant follow-up, her remarks on Loving v. Virginia, delivered a year after the death of Mildred Loving in 2008, describes one of the most important cases the U.S. Supreme Court has ever decided. In that 1967 case, the court declared Virginia's miscegenation law unconstitutional. Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote for a unanimous court that restricting the freedom to marry solely because of racial classifications violates the central meaning of the Equal Protection Clause. Remarks on the value of diversity, again informed by comparative side glances, considers the law and practice of affirmative action, which Ginsburg characterizes as endeavors to make the equality ideal more than aspirational. Hired as the first woman in a tenured position at Columbia Law School, Justice Ginsburg claims to have been the beneficiary of the Nixon administration's effort to encourage colleges and universities to hire women faculty. Indeed, she labeled 1972 the year of the woman because of the number of women hired that year into all or nearly all male institutions. Her lecture traces the legal status of affirmative action from its origins in the 1960s through its ups and downs in Supreme Court opinions, such as Bakke, 1978, and Gratz and Grutter, 2003. An affirmative action case decided after she gave the diversity lecture, Fisher v. University of Texas, is included among her oral dissents. Justice Ginsburg points to the attention-riveting line from a 2007 opinion, which held unconstitutional Seattle's plan to maintain integrated elementary and high schools by taking account of race in assigning children to particular schools. The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Ginsburg joined the dissenters in the contrary view. There is a legal and practical difference between the use of race-conscious criteria to keep the races apart and the use of race-conscious criteria to bring the races together. As she told her audience, it is her belief that we will all profit from a more diverse, inclusive society, understanding, accommodating, even celebrating our difference while pulling together for the common good. I dissent. Not included in this chapter are any of Justice Ginsburg's majority, concurring, or dissenting opinions, a representative sample of which would fill this entire volume and then some. For the opinions of the court, readers can go to the Supreme Court website, supremecourt.gov, or to the official United States reports, available in hard copy in every law library. In their stead, we present some of Ginsburg's most notable legal opinions in their most abbreviated and least technical form, the bench announcement. Bench announcements are the oral summaries of majority opinions, and much less frequently, dissenting opinions, delivered in the courtroom to waiting press and onlookers when the court issues newly minted opinions. The bench announcements of her pathmarking majority opinion in United States v. Virginia is reproduced. Several dissents she found important enough to announce from the bench are also presented. But first, to prepare you, we bring you a lecture on dissents delivered by Justice Ginsburg in Paris in 2013. In it, she examines the occasions for and virtues and vices of dissenting opinions, a subject I have been obliged to think about more than occasionally in recent terms. The reasons for her heightened attention to dissents are not too far to seek. Recent years have brought changes in the composition of the court and her position within it. Since the appointment of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, in opinions where the 9 justices split 5-4, the 5, more often than not, were the court's conservative members, and the 4 in dissent, the more liberal justices. With these appointments, the court emerged from one of the longest periods in its history without a change in personnel, 11 years, during which Justices Ginsburg and Breyer were at the bottom of the court's hierarchy, Ginsburg at number 8 and Breyer at number 9. With the retirement of Justices Souter, 2009, and Stevens, 2010, and the arrival of Justices Sotomayor, 2009, and Kagan, 2010, Ginsburg became the most senior justice in the liberal group and the oldest member of the court. In 5-4 cases with a conservative-liberal split, therefore, she became the one to decide who would write the dissenting opinion. In short, Justice Ginsburg had come into her own. Characteristically, in this lecture on dissenting opinions, she envisions dissents as part of a conversation among the justices. As the drafts circulate, the back and forth between the author of the majority opinion and the dissenter strengthens the court's final product. As Justice Ginsburg explains, dissents also speak to the public, to Congress, and to future courts. She distinguishes between dissents in cases involving interpretation of federal statutes, which put the ball back in Congress's court, and dissents on constitutional matters, which appeal to the intelligence of a future day. The selection of her most significant announcements of dissents from the bench, including several she discusses in her lecture on dissents, immediately follow the lecture. Highlights of a year at the court. The chapter that begins with Justice Ginsburg's description of the workways of the Supreme Court ends with her review of a single term's work. Every year, in late May or early June, the justice addresses the annual judicial conference for the Second Circuit, presenting the highlights of the term just ending. She then updates the review when the term is completed. The completed highlights of the 2015-16 term, hot off the presses as this book went to print, are the justice's final words in this collection of her work.